Blog Talk Radio.
Talking about faith and practice, focusing on creating communities of action. And I think in the first part of this broadcast, I'm going to start off by explaining, you know, what is the difference between a community of faith and a community of practice, or as they say in the Buddhist communities, practice centers. What is the difference? Because a lot of people right off the bat may not really be able to see what that difference is. Those of us that were raised in Christian denominations, coming from that background, we go to church or went to church with the idea, okay, what can the church do for me? You know, I have a need, I want it to be filled, and I want the church to do it for me. Kind of the same way that folks go to the doctor today. Folks will go to the doctor and say, I'm sick, heal me, or I'm broken, fix me. And we focus on the doctor doing his or her job to fix us. Now that is more of a center of faith, where you believe you have a need, or you're broken in some way, and that you need fixing, and that somebody outside of you, another agent, be it the church, the minister, the community, God, somebody outside of you needs to be doing the fixing. And it doesn't speak well to personal responsibility, because when we go into any institution with that attitude of, I'm broken, fix me, we're not really prepared to take responsibility for our own healing, for our own fixing, for our own transformation. We're focusing on the church or the synagogue or the mosque to do it for us, or we're focusing on certain people to do that for us. And a community of action, a practice community, the attitude is different. There is still an element of faith there. There may still be the realization that I'm broken, or there's something in my life that isn't like it should be. I want to grow. And this is where it differs. I am willing to take the responsibility to grow. I'm going to sit down with the doctor, as it were, and I'm going to see what the doctor's diagnosis is. But then rather than just taking pills or going in for major surgery and giving the doctor total responsibility for fixing me, I'm going to have a discussion with the doctor. I'm going to have a discussion with the leader of this community or leaders of the community and find out, okay, what have I been doing wrong? I mean, I've been living on a diet of Cheerios and chocolate bars, and I am feeling just fat, bloated, sick, tired. Am I doing something wrong here? And I'm going to be willing to listen to what the leader has to say. And when the leader recommends a certain course of action, such as, okay, keep the Cheerios, in the morning, add in a few other things like fruits and vegetables, lay off the chocolate bars for crying out loud, and just start eating some real food and see if that doesn't clear things up in a little while. When the advice comes in like that from somebody who knows what they're talking about, somebody who walks the walk, somebody that knows their stuff, and they have a history of putting that wisdom, knowledge, into practice, then I am going to take responsibility for following that advice and doing what has been recommended to me, at least trying it out. And that is what a practice community, a center of practice, allows us to do. We go in, we listen to the recommendation given by people who have been either in the same position that we are now or a similar position that we are now, listening to what they have to say, sharing their witness, their stories, of how they have changed their life by following this practice, by walking this walk, and then we are left with a decision. Are we going to take this practice and adopt it as our own, try it out for a certain length of time and see if it works? Or are we just going to turn our back, walk away, and look for another community that suits us better, or perhaps just tickles our fancy a little bit better? I didn't really realize it, but my idea, my understanding of church from my earliest age has always been kind of a mixture of the two. You know, community of faith, community of practice, but I have always leaned more strongly on the side of a community of practice. And when I would go into churches in leadership roles and hear of people who were leaving the church for what I thought were just darned awful reasons, it shocked me. Like, for example, there was one family that was going to a church where I was served as an elder, and they left the church because they didn't like the choir. The choir music wasn't up to their standards. And I thought the choir music was great. And we lived down in the Missouri Ozarks, about 90 miles away from Branson. And when I heard that that family had left the church because they didn't like the choir, I thought, that's a terrible reason to be going to church in the beginning. If you want good music, go to Branson. You know, you can go down in the middle of the week and catch a concert, or Friday night or Saturday night and catch a really good concert, you know, something to your liking. Nowadays, they practically have something for everybody down there. You shouldn't be going to the church simply because you think it's a pretty good concert. And my understanding was and is that we go to church not necessarily for something that the church has to meet our need, like good choir music or a good youth group or a good singles group. I mean, these are nice things to have on the side. It's it's a nice icing to put on your cake. But the main part of the cake should be, what can this church or synagogue or mosque or temple teach me to live a healthier, fuller spiritual life? And is this church able to put this teaching into a language that I can understand and grow with? And ideally, this teaching should come out in a variety of different ways. Like, it can come out in the church music. It can come out in the choir. It can come out in Bible study. It can come out in the sermon, the message that the church leader gives once a week or twice weekly. It can come out in a variety of ways, but that needs to be the primary emphasis, is what can this center of practice or center of faith and practice teach me to help me live a fuller life? And then there's another angle that I've totally ignored too, and that is, how can I, as a fellow student, a fellow seeker, help others to realize their fuller potential and grow spiritually as well? I'm going to take a break, and we're going to play some music. This will not be a concert at Branson type of music, but I've kind of mixed it up a little bit. I have some music by Blind Willie Johnson, an old singer from the early 20th century who also raised up a house of prayer and left his mark on the communities of the 20th century. And then also I have some Eastern music, Indian-style music by Susan Tang. But my first song is going to be by Blind Willie Johnson, God Don't Never Change.
Had God, I don't never change. He's God, always will be God. God in the middle of the ocean, God in the middle of the sea, by the help of the great creator, truly been a God to me. He's God, God don't never change. God always will be God. God in the creation, God when Adam fell, God way up in heaven, God way down in hell. He's God. God don't never change. God always will be God. Spoke to the mountain, said how great I am. Want you to get up this morning, skip around like a lamb. Well, he's God. God don't never change. God always will be God. God in the time of sickness, God in the doctor too, in the time of the influenza, he truly was a God to you. Well, he's God. God don't never change. He's God. Always will be God. God in the pulpit, God way down at the door, he's God in the amen corner. God all over the floor. Well, he's God. God don't never change. God always will be God. Mm-hmm.
Okay, that was Blind Willie Johnson, a composer, singer, minister, leader of a house of prayer from the early 20th century. Story of Blind Willie is a very inspirational one. He was born to a poor family down in Texas, and when he was quite young, he had the very strong feeling that he wanted to be a minister, and he wanted to be a singer. He loved music. He loved God, as he understood God. And he had a mishap, a very serious mishap, when he was young. You see, Blind Willie was not born blind. There was an incident in his family where his father, at least this is the story that I heard, there was an instance where his father was believed to be cheating with another woman, and his wife found out about it, and in a fit of anger, Blind Willie's mother took a cup of lye and threw it at Blind Willie's father. Well, somehow Blind Willie got in between his mother and his father, and rather than the acid hitting his father, it hit Blind Willie in the face. And he caught a lot of it in his eyes, and he was blinded from that day forward. But Blind Willie did not take his disability that seriously, where he thought it would ruin his entire life. Blind Willie went on and fashioned his first guitar out of a cigar box and a few strings that he was able to find around the house, built his own guitar, taught himself how to play it, and then began composing his own songs. He went on to become a street performer. Another story that his father would take him down on the street corner on Saturdays and let him play, and he would tie a little tin cup around the boy's neck, and he would be singing for nickels, dimes, pennies, you know, whatever the folks had in their pockets that they could give to the boy. And he went on from that to taking his music more seriously. Obviously, he recorded a few albums. He raised up a house of prayer in, I believe, in Texas. And he committed himself wholeheartedly to his mission as he saw it. And that mission was to allow people to see that God was in their life, at least from his perspective, the God as he understood God, and he tried to awaken this vision of God in the hearts and minds and inner eye of the people that he dealt with. Now, over time, Blind Willie did rather well. I mean, well enough. He was able to keep a roof over his head and food on his table until there was a time when his house of prayer burned down. And Blind Willie, I can imagine he was devastated. He stayed with his house of prayer, though. He slept in the burned-out ruins of his little church and stayed there until he died of pneumonia, showing his commitment to the very end, at least, as he saw it. He was committed. If he couldn't raise those walls back up again, then he would fade away in the burned-down ruins of those walls. And that can be seen as an example of faith in action. Blind Willie wasn't dependent upon somebody to give him his first guitar. He built it out of what he had. He wasn't dependent on somebody teaching him how to play that guitar. He had two good ears, which made up for the loss of his eyes, and he used them. He was dependent on others for their contributions, their help in getting some records recorded, their help in raising up a house of prayer. But he put everything he had, his time, his talents, what earthly resources he had, into building up that community of faith and action into building up that house of prayer. And when that house of prayer burned, he went with it. Now, some people might say that was a failure to let go, that he should have had the strength and courage to let go of that place and move on to wherever it was that God was calling him. But we also have to remember that for a blind black man in the Deep South in the early 20th century, you had a lot going against you. Opportunities did not come very often, even self-made opportunities. And with Blind Willie, I have a feeling that he showed his dedication to his mission by both living it and sticking with it after it burned down, and essentially dying with it so that it might be born anew in another form, in another life, in another realm. So there we have a good example, I believe, of faith in action, a community of practice where you know you have a purpose. You know you have a mission. You know you have issues in your life that need to be addressed, and you are willing to take responsibility for addressing those issues and growing into the person that you are called to become. A lot of us have the point of view that we are human beings, that we are what we are, and that's true. But the flip side of that coin is that we are also human becomers, and that we are constantly growing into that which we are ultimately destined to become. But it's more than just fate, and it's more than just destiny. We have to take personal responsibility to make that growth happen, to allow that growth to happen, to grow with God. God don't never change, but men and you-uns and us-uns, we all be in the need of change. And we do change, and we grow. And from the perspective of God, God sees the finished product. He plants the seed, but he sees the apple growing on the vine at the same time. Time is eternal for God. There is no temporal reality, at least in the ultimate highest realms of the divine. The only time is the eternal now. So God sees the whole picture. The planting of the seed, to the budding of the blossom, to the apple hanging on the vine, on the branch. That's all seen in one blink of an eye, in an instant. And for us, sometimes it's the work of a lifetime. At least the work of many, many years. So God don't never change, but we do. And we need to grow. And in order to grow, we need to take responsibility for our growth and team ourselves up with folks who can help us to grow. I'm going to take another break. This time we're going to go from Blind Willie to Susan Teng, Fertile Crescent. Rider Ralph back. In preparing for this talk this morning, I was reminded of stories that I heard, stories I read concerning the early Christian communities. And by that, I mean the early communities centered around the teachings of Jesus before the term Christian came into popular usage. So it's actually not really the early Christian communities, but we might call them the earliest pre-Christian Jewish communities, messianic Jewish communities, who followed Jesus as their Messiah. Now, that said, that's a mouthful, but we have to keep in mind that Christianity as we know it is a relatively recent development. And Christianity, as folks in the first century knew it, did not take place until after the preaching of Paul, when Paul began to take the teachings of Jesus, the Jewish teachings of Jesus, and try to adapt them to the understanding and taste of folks in the Gentile communities. And if we take a look at the earliest pre-Christian communities who tried to live out the teachings of Jesus, we don't really see what we would call centers of faith being established. I mean, they were people that had this faith that Jesus was the Messiah, that he was a master teacher, that his spiritual teachings had power to them. So they had that level of faith, but their main emphasis was on how to put that faith into action. And what we know from a reading of the New Testament and a little Christian document, first century Jesus movement document called the Didache, is that the first believers did not meet together as we do today once a week for church. Their idea of community went beyond that. Our idea of community is just that. I mean, we move into a neighborhood because it's a nice neighborhood, and we find a church either somewhere in our neighborhood or within a reasonable driving distance from our neighborhood. And we go to that church and we give 10% of our income on a good week, maybe less if we can't afford the 10%, maybe only a few dollars in the collection plate. But we give what we feel comfortable giving. And as long as that church suits our needs, as long as we feel comfortable in that place of worship, we remain there. But then somewhere along the line, if we feel that the theology of the pastor isn't quite up to snuff, up to par with our own, if we have a disagreement in the women's fellowship or in the men's prayer group, get into a fight with somebody, then 9 times out of 10, let's say, we're pretty comfortable breaking fellowship with that community. We may have the attitude, I was looking for a church when I found this one, and I can be out there looking again, by God. And our idea of community, being members of a center of faith and practice, is not as strong as it was in the first century. Because for us, that tie can be broken so easily. I live in a neighborhood where, God, I lose track of how many Baptist churches there are. And a lot of them, I won't say all of them, that we have some very beautiful, wonderful Baptist pastors in our area, and then we have some that just think that they are the only people doing God's work and God's will, and their church is the only real church. But, I mean, we have so many, and what happens is folks go to a church, they feel like their needs are not being met, or they get into an argument and they leave that church, and then they go down the road and they build another church, and we have so many churches that have sprung up like that. One in recent memory where a pastor got run out of one church, so he ran up into the next town, which was just a 15-minute drive away, and rented another church and created his own little community of faith right there. But our idea of commitment is just so lukewarm compared to what it was in the first century that there really is no comparison. Because from our reading of the New Testament literature and our reading of the Didache states that when people joined the earliest community of faith in action centered around the teachings of Jesus, they didn't just give 10%. They gave it all. They tried to live out the teachings of Jesus, go, sell all that you have, give the proceeds to the poor, and then when you have nothing, come and be my disciple. That was the instructions given by Jesus to many of his would-be followers, and to many of his committed followers. And it was a message that the first communities of faith and practice took to heart. See, what we know, I'm going to read this from Acts chapter 2, the fellowship of believers. They devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to the fellowship, to the breaking of the bread and to prayer. Everyone was filled with awe, and many wonders and miraculous signs were done by the apostles. All the believers were together and held everything in common. Selling their possessions and goods, they gave to anyone as they had need. Every day they continued to meet together in the temple courts. They broke bread in their homes and ate together with glad and sincere hearts, praising God and enjoying the favor of all the people. Now, from that we can understand that what the people of the first century did as members of a community of practice, they sold all their possessions and they gave them to the apostles, and those funds were given to support the wider fellowship of the Christian community and to basically provide bread and sustenance to members of the community. And their idea of community wasn't that, okay, I've got my own home in this neighborhood and I'm going to drive in my car and I'm going to drive to the church of my liking and go to church there. We know from a reading from the Didache that when folks joined the Christian community, it was like moving into the community. Folks lived together. They had their own homes, but they were built up in a physical community where you could get out and you could walk, you know, to your Christian neighbor. And you could get up and you could walk to the building that you were using as either a synagogue or a temple or a church. And everything was pretty much self-contained. Today we would call that more of a commune, where people sell everything they have, whatever properties they have, you know, whatever extraneous possessions they have, and they would give all that to the commune, to the community, and then they would depend on the community to meet their physical needs, and they would work to support that community. In the Didache, this comes up very strongly. There's a passage which reads, when one wants to join your community, if he has a trade, then let him work at that trade to support the community. But if he does not have a trade, if he does not have a talent that he can use to support himself and the community, then let the community decide the manner of work that he will do in order to support himself and the community. Now, I'm paraphrasing on that because I don't have the exact translation right in front of me. But from that quote, from that paraphrase, we can tell that the earliest believers, they didn't just join a church. They committed themselves to a commune, to a community. And they dedicated themselves to living out that commitment, supporting the community through their work, and then giving the proceeds of that work to the community with the faith, with the trust, that as one had need, that physical need would be taken care of. And today we would call this socialism, but the way it was put into practice in the earliest Christian community was from each according to their ability and to each according to their need. And it wasn't what we would call a church relationship, where you go to a church, you give 5 or 10% of your income, or maybe not even that, and you stay as long as it tickles your fancy to stay there. It was making a commitment. It was like getting married. It wasn't something where you just go into it, and as long as it's good, I'll stay, and when things get rough, I'll leave. It was your life commitment. It was like Blind Willie going back to the ruins of his house of prayer and laying down in the ashes because he had given his entire life, body, and soul to building up that house of prayer. And when it was reduced to ashes, so was he. And it was a similar level of commitment in the earliest Jesus communities. Communes, if you will, that I give my life to this community. And if the community prospers and thrives, so shall I. And if the community withers and dies and is destroyed or perishes, at least from a temporal perspective, in temporal terms, then perish, so shall I. And it's a very deep level of commitment. And it's a very deep level of practice. And it's a level of practice that we really don't see, except in exceptional cases. And we do see these cases. You know, Blind Willie was one. And, you know, there are people out there living today who give themselves to street communities, street missions, that build up a following dedicated to helping people of that community, helping to transform their little part of the world, and to definitely work to transform their local community. And there are folks who give themselves wholeheartedly to that work. But 9 times out of 10, what we see mostly is just that lukewarm commitment where I'm going to join a church and give my weekly tithe, keep the lion's share of my material goods for myself and my family, and then if something happens in the church where the church goes under or where I get into a disagreement with somebody, I can just get out of there, go back to my own little home, and live out my own little quiet and happy life. And for a community of practice and commitment, it's a far, far deeper relationship than just all that. I'm going to stop right now and play another song by Blind Willie Johnson, Soul of a Man.
Well, want somebody to tell me, answer if you can. Want somebody to tell me, just what is the soul of a man? I'm going to ask to question, please answer if you can. Is there anybody sure and can tell me just what is the soul of a fellow? What somebody tell me? Answer if you can. I want somebody to tell me just what is the soul of a man. I traveled different countries, I've traveled in forest land. I've found nobody could tell me just what about the soul of a man. When I want somebody, tell me. Answer if you can. I want somebody to tell me just what is the soul of a man. I saw a crowd stand talking, I just came up in time. Was teaching the lawyer, the doctor. Well, a man need nothing but his mind. Well, I want somebody to tell me. Answer if you can. I want somebody to tell me just what is the soul of a man. God, I want somebody to tell me. Answer if you can. I want somebody to tell me just what is the soul of a man. I read the Bible often, I tried to read it right, and for as I could understand nothing but a burning. God, I want somebody to tell me. Answer if you can. I want somebody to tell me just what is the soul of a man. When Christ sat in the temple, the people all stood amazed. Was teaching the lawyers, doctors, how to raise a man from the grave. Well, I want somebody to tell me. Answer if you can. Want somebody to tell me just what is the soul of a man. Well, I want somebody to tell me. Answer if you can. I want somebody to tell me just what is the soul of a man.
I'm pretty sure that Blind Willie probably realized this or something similar to this, but as I understand it, the soul of a man emanates from the divine source. It's energy fashioned from the divine source as a baby is fashioned, as it were, from the genetic materials of an earthly father and an earthly mother. And it's energy emanating from this divine source, this male-female divine source, that gives birth to a soul, as it were, which comes down through many stages of focusing and development. It's broken up into many different souls, as it were, bits and pieces, as it were, individuating from the one whole source into individuals and coming into the hearts of all living flesh, taking on individual forms like a man or a woman would put on a new set of clothes. And from that description of a human soul, we can see that all souls are in common. All souls descend from a common source. You can call it the Tao, you can call it the Source, the All, the One, God, Goddess, the Almighty. I like to think of it as the Almighty He, She, and It. I don't say it that way very often because a slip of the tongue can really doom that. Most of the times I just call him, her, he, she. and I leave the it out. But we're all one. We're broken into different bits and pieces, like tongues of fire, like sparks emanating from a common bonfire, and we come to rest in earthly vessels. But we all come from the one source, and to the one source we shall all ultimately return. And that understanding gives power to the concept that I am responsible in this life for more than just myself. I am responsible for my neighbor, because in a very real way, I am my neighbor. I am in my neighbor as my neighbor is in me. And all things, me, myself, and I, and my neighbor, and the stray cats that keep turning up at our doorstep, we are all different manifestations of the one great source. And we are all one family, although we don't see it very clearly in this life. And that gives teeth to the idea of practice. Seeking out help for ourselves in our practice, because these realizations are not obvious. A lot of these realizations that, you know, we have to grow in order to live a more full spiritual life, these are observations that are not obvious, that are hidden, that are esoteric, and we need help in order to see this, and we need help in order to understand it. And for many of us, these understandings do not just come to us in the blink of an eye. They are the fruit of many, many years of trying to open our minds to the understanding. Many years of opening our hearts. Many years spent trying to get our minds wrapped around this, even if only in the form of analogy, because analogy and illusion are powerful tools to help us imagine and see in our mind's eye and the eye of spirit these truths which are hidden in the material world. But in time, when they are pointed out to us and we can see them for ourselves, for what they are, then we too can see and live and grow with that faith and put that faith into practice. Now, some folks would say that a community of practice is superior to a community of faith. And a little while ago, I would have agreed with that analysis. But as I see it now, both are necessary. These understandings of the spiritual life, especially the more esoteric ones, like what is the soul of a man, or the soul of a woman, or the soul of a person, or the soul of a dog or a cat, for that matter, they are not obvious, and we need help in order to fully understand, or at least come to the beginnings of an understanding, and to be able to ask the right questions rather than be focused on having all the right answers. We need help. And when we're growing, as a child would, as a baby would, we need a community of faith where the understanding that these things are even remotely possible are preserved and presented to us. And then as our understanding grows, when we get to the point of being able to go beyond blind faith, and step out on faith and put those teachings into practice, then we learn not just from our faith, but from our practice, from our experience. We take what we were taught as children, and we take it out to the street, and we begin to live it. And then we begin to experience, aha, this is what it's like. Perhaps this is what Jesus spoke of. Perhaps this is what Buddha was talking about. Perhaps this is what Muhammad taught and lived in his community. And we can begin to take that experience and own that experience and then share that experience with others. So we move from blind faith and faith alone to practice, experience, and then a bit of knowledge. And then we come to realize that what we took on faith before was either flawed in some way or right on the mark, because we've lived it and we've seen it in action, and we have a substantial part of that that we can claim for ourselves and then lovingly present to others, and then they will begin the whole journey for themselves, taking our teaching and our understanding on faith, putting that into practice, living that experience, and coming to that knowledge. So it's an evolution, a development from faith to knowledge through practice. And communities of action, practice centers, are essential in helping our fellow seekers to understand and to grow and to take responsibility for their own growth and development. The difference between a community of faith and a community of practice is like the difference of taking a newborn baby and putting them in a nursery, as opposed to taking that newborn baby and putting it in a frat house at Oxford University. You wouldn't do that unless you were kind of nuts to begin with, because a newborn baby doesn't belong in a frat house unless there's a nursery in that frat house, and it's a pretty calm frat house. No, a baby deserves to be in a nursery. And as it grows, as it develops, it leaves its mother's side, goes off to kindergarten, and then grade school, and then high school, and then college, and then off to university, and then off to a frat house, and beyond that frat house, off into, you know, what we might jokingly call the real world. But it's all a series of steps, and you don't take one giant leap from newborn baby to frat house fratter and think it to be proper. We have to grow along the way. And a community of faith is a good place for a lot of folks to start. But it should not be seen as the end point. The end point should be a practice center, a community of practice, where we begin to take responsibility for our own growth and grow our own way in our own direction, with a community there to help support us, and we to help support them, to see our commonness and to embark upon our joint mission. Whatever mission the divine has given us, whatever mission that may be. But it's all a development. I'm going to leave now. And in closing, I'll play a song by Celtic Reggae Revolution, another kind of an odd mix all in itself, Gandhi's Triumph. And I'm breaking in a new broadcast schedule. I will probably be back this Sunday, and then after that, 2 90-minute broadcasts a week, and more on that later. But now we will play Gandhi's Triumph by Celtic Reggae Revolution Man.